I'm on Skid Row, let's say. And here's a man who asked me for money for a meal. And I say, fine, but let's not limit it to you. You ask for a dollar for a meal, here's $2. Will you pass one on to that poor fellow on the corner? No. That was my needs, he says. I keep it for myself. Well, this would do something to me, but worse than that, it tells me that he is not really eligible to receive anything that he will not pass on. Now, if there is an inability on our part to get a feeling of forgiveness, we need to ask ourselves whether we have truly forgiven everyone else. And I don't think I have. Once in a while, I get to the place where I can say, oh, God, I'm so grateful that I'm not mad at a living soul. I don't feel any resentment or any hostility. And an hour or a week later, all of a sudden, somebody's face will come before me. Somebody who I haven't been able to stand. I can't endure them. And I haven't been aware up to this point that it's somebody I dislike or hate. It's just that I've cut them off. And then as I examine it closer, I find that I have not forgiven them. And to this extent, I cannot have God's full cleansing forgiveness. Salvation, yes. Forgiveness, no. For forgiveness, to the extent that we receive it, will always be partial. Now, theologically, I'm distinguishing here between salvation, which is God's free gift, and between the cleansing that comes when we are forgiven for our offenses. In one of our groups, there's a young, brilliant young man who grew up in a strange and warped religious environment. And he has two brothers who are ministers, one of a kind of oddball, we call it, but very devout group of people meeting in homes, and they're very restrictive, and so he describes it with wit and humor and pathos. The other became a kind of a fundamentalist minister, a chaplain. His father got converted to Christianity late in life and wept and moaned his way through his religious experiences, and the boy, as a youngster, felt a need to go along with this in order to win approval. He felt approved only if he could be as pious or sound as pious or act as pious as they were. So he developed a great sense of hypocrisy. He knew he was a hypocrite. He knew he didn't feel it. Ultimately, he grew up as a brilliant young engineer with a feeling of worthlessness, of being inadequate and unworthy. He said, I know, as he put it, I'm no damn good. He said, I know I'm not going to be fired intellectually, but emotionally I feel I ought to be and that I will be any moment. See, the intellect and the emotions aren't always linked closely together. He said, furthermore, he's repeated this many times in the group. He said, my feeling is that ministers are rat finks. All ministers. Now, there's no animosity toward me. He comes a long distance to get into this group. He doesn't belong to our church. Inwardly, he senses, subconsciously, that having been marred by religion, he can only be healed by religion. He doesn't know this yet. Having been marred by ministers, I think he senses he will have to be healed by ministers. So when he says ministers are all finks, and he says it vehemently, what he's really doing is saying to me, if I push you enough, will you reject me? Well, I don't feel anything when he says ministers are finks, because I don't think they all are, like he said. I don't go along with that fully. And I don't think that is quite an accurate description of the way I feel about myself. That is, that isn't a term I would use, so I neither accept it or reject it. I just listen to it. Well, I don't reject him, I love him, and the odd thing about it is he loves me. He's a very tender, gentle, considerate, loving person. The astounding thing is that with all of his guilt and worthlessness and self-rejection, that he has any psychic energy left to love anybody. But when somebody else in the group is in trouble, he will call them from his office and say to one of the women, "Honey, did you make it? Did you get that apartment you were worrying about?" You see, he has a strong capacity for love for other people, but he hates himself. All right, now this is a very serious case. Everybody in the group loves him. They tell him they love him. Women in the group go up to him and put their arms around him and say, "You know we love you." "Yes," he says, "I know." And he sounds as if he's never a friend in the world. Now, some people, depending on the degree of scar tissue, could be healed this way in a night, a month, 6 months. It may take him 5 years. He has been tragically, deeply scarred and marred by false religion. And the Lord only knows what else. But he senses that this is the way, and he is determined. He drives an hour to get here, there. He spends about 2 hours there and an hour home. It takes 4 hours. But he comes and sits there looking like the lost soul he feels himself to be, trying to feel inwardly what he knows intellectually is there, love and acceptance and forgiveness. In this case, we simply have to give him more over a longer period of time. Isaac Mir, one of the ancient Jewish rabbis, has a passage about this, and we'll close here in a minute. He says, thinking about wallowing in our guilt, he says, "Still filth this way or that, it is still filth. To have sinned or not to have sinned, what does it profit us in heaven? In the time spent brooding on this, I could be stringing pearls for the joy of heaven. You have done wrong, confess it and start doing right." But it isn't quite that easy, but in essence, he is right. There's no point in just stirring the filth, the garbage, the failure of our lives, going over it and over it and over it and over it. We are to seek to get it up, get it out, and move on. I think David, having written his down, found great release. You remember how David had lusted after another man's wife. He saw her across the roof, on the rooftop of another house. Well, this isn't uncommon. Women do it, men do it, people do it. We lust after people or things. So, the tragic thing is that when we are in love or in lust, it often mars our judgment, even our moral values. You remember how he had the woman's husband, who was in the army, sent up to the front. After all, somebody had to die. Might as well be this woman's husband. And if God willed that he should die, well, all right, if God willed that he should live. You see how this poet, this mystic, this child of God got so warped that he was doing this crazy thinking. The man is killed. So then, David felt justified in taking Bathsheba as his one of his wives. Later on, Prophet Nathan came in and told him a little parable and got him upset. And then finally Nathan said, "You are the man." He was discovered. Gee, don't we hate to be discovered? Have the finger put on us. Then comes this beautiful psalm. This is only a part of it. "Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy steadfast love. According to thy abundant mercy, blot out my transgression. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. For I know my transgression, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee only have I sinned. Purge me with hyssop, and I shall be clean. Wash me, and I shall be whiter than snow. Hide thy face from my sins and blot out all my iniquity. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation. He was depressed, you see, because of guilt. Now he wants the joy. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. And then with considerable insight he says, the sacrifice acceptable to God is a broken spirit. A broken and a contrite spirit, O God, thou wilt not despise. Well, there's nothing wrong with any of us except what was wrong with him. Failure to discover and to live up to these universal cosmic laws, whether they are laws of physics, of chemistry, of health, or of the spirit. Okay, let's have some discussion now for a while. What has come to your mind while we have been talking here?
I'm wondering, as you use this man of Mars on false religion, it really raised a question in my mind in terms of what you mean by false religion.
I was not referring to the particular denomination. I was referring to the fact it was a false emphasis. At least now I'm being judgmental in this case, and I think it's a valid evaluation, though. It was a judgmental religion. There were 13 or 30 different things that you couldn't do, and 60 things which if you did, that made you a Christian. They were very moralistic, very pharisaical. They wept a great deal about lost souls. They didn't do much for people, but they worried about their souls. They were trying to save souls, not save people. And the sadness, the sad songs, the hymns they sang, all were sufficient to warp him. I think I'm projecting a little now. I grew up in an atmosphere similar to that that warped me. Which is why I feel a little better about it.
You gave some illustrations about confession and confession in either a small room or illustrations I can remember with this one person, like to you. I think that makes the person free on the view, and you feel different toward that person. But how is the person really going to be free generally, or with people in general? Do they have to confess? I mean, now you said no, but I'm wondering, I'm just following this. Maybe they should.
I doubt if we can give a categorical answer. First of all, there are people who, I know, just in communion with God have received the sense of forgiveness and cleansing. Second, there are people who, in confessing to a priest or a minister or to a friend, have thus been open to everyone. I remember a man who shared with me the specific nature of his wrongdoing, and I said, he asked, should I share this with the group? And I said, that's up to you, entirely up to you. He said, you think I should? And I said, well, why don't you decide that? If you ever feel that it will give you a greater sense of release, fine. If not, you need not. I didn't feel any need to be rigid about it. He went for about 6 months before he was ready. And one night he opened up and told the group for about 20 minutes all about it. Now, he got an added sense of release by sharing it with the group and sensing that they loved him and accepted him. It may, I'm not sure about this, it may bear a relationship to the kind of persons we are, how ready and available we are to God's forgiveness. It may have to do also with the extent to which we feel guilty, punish ourselves with self-condemnation. I don't know. All I can say is some can do it with one, some need to do it on a more open basis. Dr. O. Hobart Maurer feels, as a psychologist, that one needs to share the whole ball of wax with what he calls significant others, that is, other people, a group of people, of your peers, of people whose judgment you value. Yes, it's the new maneuver therapy, yeah, by Wolfgang Maurer. There's one right here and then another here.
I guess once you were a minute ago that you probably don't need to confess to everyone. You need to, for example, even most of them be judgmental. And if we have received the therapy from the first confession, then we can perhaps feel the forgiveness of God and can therefore forgive ourselves and therefore the cleansing that you do there.
I think we have to be guided, yes, as you've indicated, by our own internal feelings. There's one here first, then, Jerry. Yes?
I wonder if we have a feeling how much sharing you feel is effective. Do you share with your group of yourself what is effective at all? Not
judgmental. I feel a need for the group, generally, to share enough so that I have exposed myself some. And I'm willing to expose myself more if there's any value. And I think I play it by ear. Nothing would be gained by starting a group and saying, I want to tell you the story of my life, of all the sordid experiences that come to mind. Nothing to be gained by it. So I share enough to let them sense that I'm not going to judge them, that I'm not in the position to judge them. Now, and here's why we can't give a categorical answer. I shared this with the group here once. In a minister's group that I was leading and had been leading for a couple of years, one man one day said rather testily, you sit there week after week, but you never share. And I said, well, I have been giving this some thought. I said, consciously, I would like to share more, but we get going and I don't feel like taking up too much of the time, but if you fellows are willing to give me the time, I'd like to do some sharing next week. So next week came, we got started, and I began to open up, and somebody made a wisecrack. Not at my expense, just a wisecrack. I started again, and somebody else made a wisecrack. And it's a facetious, whimsical, serious, wonderful group of fellows. But after about 5 or 10 minutes, one of the associates on my staff said, hold it, let's see what's going on. He said, Dr. O here has been trying for the last 10 or 15 minutes to participate and share. There have been 19 interruptions since he started. What are we doing? Well, they thought about it a while, and somebody said, maybe we are ambivalent. We want him to share because we know intellectually he's just like we are, no better, no worse. Emotionally, we'd like for him to be a fixed point and not really expose himself. Now, this ambivalence is probably present in most groups. They want you to share, but they also want you to be a fixed point. You just have to play it by ear.
Your humanity, your fallibility. From that point on, everything has to be played on a unique, relative to a particular situation, particular time basis. And what skills do effectively cannot be brought to bear?
Yeah, you can only operate on the basis of general principles, general guidelines. We have to, and I think a leader can get to the place where he operates with a certain spiritual and emotional spontaneity in response to people, in response to the circumstance, rather than thinking, what should I do now?
Is that what a term has to break down to?
Yeah. Yeah.
Eventually, she got into a conversation with me. And as time went on,
I think so. There are people who can get enough courage from a group to go to a private counselor and get from him the release that they need. Some people have gone to a group for a while and gotten courage to go to a psychiatrist whom they should have gone to in the first place. Did you have a comment?
Yes. Mauer was talking on TV on the channel. Colbert Mauer was talking on TV on Channel 6, was stating that very often he would get a client who would be able to talk to him. Then perhaps ten people, maybe he and his wife are in a very selective group. Then he would be selected to group open up. That he was very concerned about being a selective group. That he was taking step by step to gradually.
All right, we're not here.
Dorothy, would you please talk about that fifth point as far as the leader is concerned? I don't know how to quite understand what you mean. One of the fifth points.
Yes. Yeah, this inner child within us, and if any of you haven't read Your Inner Child of the Past, buy one today. It's $5.95, but worth a lot more. This inner child within us wants an authority figure. The authority figure, as a child, you see, was father, mother. But the inner child is never dead. The little boy is never dead in the man. The little girl is never dead in the woman. There may be times in a day, or perhaps in an hour, sometimes in a single sentence, when the adult here and the parent here will be speaking, all these three segments of the personality. The superego, of course, is the parent incorporated within us in a moral sense, our conscience. The child down here, the id, is the child and primitive impulses. The adult is the central portion. Now, a person, for instance, who says, and I have to go through all of this to answer your question. A person who says, I think I will have a chocolate nut sundae. I guess perhaps I shouldn't. I'm already 72 pounds overweight or whatever. That's the parent rebuking. And the adult says, maybe, I think I'll settle for a glass of milk and some crackers. Now, in that little exchange of one or two sentences, you heard the child, the parent, and the adult all speaking. And finally, the adult becomes the chairman of this committee of three persons always fighting within us. All right. Now, in a group, the child comes out quite often. The child needs. In fact, one purpose of the group is for this child to grow up and to mature somewhat. All right, this child needs a parent figure, an authority figure in the group. It may not always be the leader. A minister, a priest, a strong personality, or a quiet, authoritative person in the group. Any of these may become, to any of us, authority figures. Some people fear authority figures. If we were afraid of our parents, our parents are judgmental, we fear them, but need them. So, intellectually, one may say in the group, our leader sits there as though he had it made, morally and spiritually pure, and we know he isn't. Why does he never share? But if he comes out from behind his authority figure role, imposed upon him by the group, and says, this week I'd like to share my own inadequacies. I am a frightened, insecure person with many inadequacies. A part of the individual listening is glad to know that this leader is no longer a threat and has fears, inadequacies, guilt. But the child is saying, no, Daddy, don't tell us all of this. We want you, we need somebody here as a fixed point. Who's going to run the show? Who's going to call the shots? So we're usually ambivalent about this in a group. It depends a lot on the maturity of the group. Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
You mentioned playing it by ear. played by ear, will make mistakes, of course, and misjudge individually. And how can we prevent or overcome the tendency of some people to take offense at and fly the coop?
Take offense at what?
Well, at some question we ask or some statement we make.
In the first place, we cannot always guarantee that everyone will stay in a group. I have had groups where everyone stayed with it for many, many months or several years. I remember another group at the other extreme where we started with, I think, 9 or 10 people. A month later, there were 3. Finally settled down to a husband and wife, and I finally gave them up because they were not over. They just sat there and accused each other for 2 hours every night, and I gave them up. Now, we mustn't feel ourselves failures if a group grows sky high. Now, the leader and members of a group desperately need to learn to gauge the ego strength of each person. We sense it from within. And if a leader does not have this, it's very unfortunate. I heard just the other day of a woman who was in a group where the leader, who feels he is filled with love and has learned about love and has to some degree, still is hostile to his mother. He thinks he's worked it out, but I happen to know he hasn't fully. He's become aware of it, but hasn't resolved it, put it that way. So he feels a need to attack women and some men, mainly women. Women and any authority figure, I'll put it that way. He attacked a woman, thinking of himself as operating on her in a psychic way. And I think it was months before she recovered. Now, a leader has no business taking people apart. This is not our purpose. We have no business being accusatory, judgmental, attacking. All right, now having said that, let us also say there are people who have defenses so thick that if you don't blast with some dynamite, you'll never get through. But some people have an ego defense about like that. And I'll give an illustration of why we have to play this by ear. At one of our Selamar retreats, one of the groups in which I sat had about 20 or 25 people, much too large. One man kept interrupting and throwing things in and making comments, a very sick fellow. And he knew he was sick. He insisted, out of his great inferiority and inadequacy, in dominating the thing, and he spoke again and again and again and again and again. And others who wanted to share couldn't get a chance. There were perhaps 6 or 8 who hadn't had a chance to open their mouth. So after a while, I began to make marks on a piece of paper every time he spoke. I finally had 41 times since I had begun that he had said something. All right, now, he regarded me, because he had a real problem with his father, who was a hostile, authoritarian person. He had a problem with me. He needed me to give him acceptance. So I didn't feel that I wanted to be the one to try to blast through his ego defenses. But it had to be done. So at one point, I said, to open up the gate for others to go through, I said, now there are about 6 or 8 who haven't had a chance this morning to share. Perhaps some of you folks would like to share here. I said, by the way, calling them. Joe here has shared quite openly this morning. By the way, how do you feel about Joe? Well, the group sensed I was just opening the door saying, you've got to take Joe on. Now, this was not timidity on my part. He needed me, because of his relation to the hospital father, he needed me to protect him, not to attack him. Somebody in there said, well, Joe burns me up. He dominates the whole discussion. Well, I said, maybe he needs to. Maybe his needs are such that he needs to have more time. Well, more time maybe, but not all this time. And there was laughter, but there was a lot of probing.
and some accusation that you dominated the whole thing. So I both opened the door and tried, in a little sense, to protect him.
Now, an interesting thing happened.
As they proceeded to attack him, not vigorously, but rudely, analytically, I looked at him, and he was enjoying it. He loved it.
He couldn't accept it.
All right, other comments, sir. This has happened a number of times. I felt a particular person needed both the group and a psychiatrist. And sometimes an individual will come to see how sick they are, how needy they are, how defensive they've been, and be willing to go to a psychiatrist and still stay in the group. I remember one woman who, well, she's in a group now. She described the group to her psychiatrist, and he said, yes, by all means, stay in the group. Come and see me once a week. She needs the acceptance of the group, and she needs the insight of the psychiatrist.
I'm wondering if I ask you, would it be my inner child coming out to want to know specifically some of those cosmic laws that you have discovered? Or do we have to discover them all for ourselves?
Well, both.
I remember about 15 years ago being very angry because it seemed to me that we break ourselves if we don't live by the laws and yet we can't find them.
All right.
And I asked the minister and he said, well, that's what life's all about, and never gave me even one clue. Now, I think I've discovered a few for myself, but is there anything that we can specifically say that we have guidelines?
How do you feel about this minister? You're hostile to him, or?
No, I love him very dearly, but I just figured that I made you a little angry with God because he left it so kind of obscure and hidden.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Sometimes I wish God had made it a little simpler. I really do. Now, we know when we get to heaven that we'll understand it. That's the way it should be. But meanwhile, it's all right to feel that it isn't easy. Yeah, now, in the sermon on, before I back up, in one of the Psalms, there are two rather widely separated statements which are very profound. I found them welling up within me once when I was in a minor crisis of some kind. This floated up out of the depths. It said, open thou mine eyes that I may behold wondrous truths out of thy law. Now here's the prayer of the psalmist. Help me to discover these cosmic laws. Then, as I was riding along, a few minutes later, another one rose up from the depths. I didn't even know what psalm it was in. It said, great peace have they who love thy laws, and nothing shall disturb them. In one translation, it reads, nothing shall offend them, and that's true also. When I got home, I looked them up, and it's both of those are in the same psalm. Now, here it is. The prayer, help me to discover these cosmic laws. When we discover them, we'll have great peace. All right? Now, what are they? Well, the Bible is a book of these cosmic laws. But if you just read the Bible from beginning to end, and there's a lot of other stuff, history, poetry, and all the rest. A good point to begin is to take the 5th, 6th, and 7th chapters of Matthew, the highly condensed form of the Sermon on the Mount, which may have gone on for hours, and underline there everything that is a basic spiritual law. Now, these obedience to these principles do not save us. They're not the things that get us into heaven. But having come to see Christ as the revelation of God, and want to follow the light, this is the way to follow the light. Now, many people read the Bible as though it would be rather get God to regard them more highly. And to read a chapter a day, well, that's foolish. Oh, it might not be a waste of time. It won't do any harm. But a far better way to read the Bible is to read it until you find something that applies to your life and underline it and lean back and close the Bible and think about it and let it sink down and say, what does this apply to me? How does this apply to me? How can I apply it to life? If you take the Sermon on the Mount and underscore every principle in there and work on that for the next 5 years, you've got all you can handle. Has a lot recommended. Now, wouldn't this also be true that the Ten Commandments are basically pretty good moral laws? The Sermon on the Mount, the commandment about love, is not out of harmony with it, is not contradictory, but transcends it, right? That is, the law, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with heart, mind, soul, and strength, thy neighbor as thyself, is, what do you call it, a law or a principle or a method of operation. It's all the same thing. This transcends the Ten Commandments, but does not nullify it, right? Well, let's see if we can incorporate what you're talking about with this. I didn't mean to suggest that all of our activities need to be motivated by stringent rules. I'm not talking about laws, but about principles. Just for the sake of discussion, suppose we thought of these vertical lines as the principles regulating or the principles concerned with man's relationship to God. For instance, we know there are certain ways by which we can communicate with God. What do you call these? Laws, principles, attitudes. It's all the same thing as far as I'm concerned. I know, for instance, that when my attitude toward God is one of openness and love, I seem to have a better relationship with Him. So let's call it an attitude of mind or a basic principle or whatever. Call this, if you like, all these horizontal lines, the principles, methods, attitudes, which, if we follow, make for better relationships between man and man, a wife and her husband, a mother and her children. Principle among these, of course, and running through both vertical horizontal lines, is the principle of love, which Jesus said, if you've observed this, you've observed the whole business. You got the whole ball whack. All right. Suppose, however, since we are given free will, as long as I am following these basic attitudes of mind or principles or whatever you want to call them, in here, I have all the freedom and the latitude that I can ever use. A frightening amount of freedom. Whether I live on First Avenue or 10th Street, in a sense, is of no particular concern to God. I'm not bound by rules. I might get some divine guidance which would predispose me to feel that 10th Avenue is somewhat better than First Avenue, or whatever. But I've got all the freedom I need to rattle around in here. Now, these cosmic laws or principles are ways by which the universe operates. Ways by which, if we operate, we'll get along better. If I bump into one of these and violate it, I hurt myself or hurt somebody else. Or I upset the sociological, psychological balance of mankind. I heard an ex-convict say something almost poetic in its insight. He spent 35 years out of his 50-something in prisons. He's running our halfway house down here now. In a conference with some chaplains and others in Southern California last week, he got to talking and rambling and said some very profound things. One was, if I hit you, everybody in the world aches. Now, that has a lot of implication. And he's talking about a cosmic principle, as I see it, which is, if I offend you, this does something to your emotional and spiritual balance, and you're out of focus in relation with the next person you meet. That does something to them, and they're out of focus with their kids when they get home. And to some degree, every person in the world gets the result. You think we're together here in what we're talking about? Not just rigid cosmic laws. Well, there is a pretty rigid universal law of gravity, I guess, atmospheric pressure. We know what atmospheric pressure is. Maybe someday somebody will discover a law that transcends this. Meanwhile, if I violate the law of atmospheric pressure, or let's say the law of gravity, and jump out of a 10-story window, I hurt myself. Therefore, I want to work in harmony with some of these laws. That's basically what I'm saying.
Dr. O, while your breath is good, you have also drawn the same simple line structure that, as you say, transcends fall, which is God's love. In that graph is also the cross, which is man to God, God to man, and man to man.
Yes, in some mystical and yet practical sense, I think you're right, Richard, the cross stands beyond the principles of psychology, beyond theology, speaking to our emotions and saying something that you can't put adequately in theological language, just saying this is the nature of God. Yes, sir.
Well, we make this all sound so complex. God has given us commandments to love ourselves and to love others, love God. That means that we have self-respect for others, we have self-respect for ourselves, we're better off. God forgives us, we forgive others, then we forgive ourselves, we're better off. God does not judge us. We do not judge someone else. We do not judge ourselves. We are better off. This is a better way to live. Why make it sound so complex?
Good. I think Jesus did this when he took the essence of all he had said for several hours, probably the Sermon on the Mount, and said, well, to summarize it, just love God and your neighbor and yourself. That's what you're doing. You're summarizing the whole thing, right?
It's the way
I don't know. I don't know that you could state any principle that would do anybody any good. I rather think this has to come from within and be felt at a subconscious level to know when a person needs to be loved, when they need to be accepted, when they need to be encouraged, when they need to be challenged. Carl Rogers was saying some time ago something that I think is very profound and might be helpful there. He says the organism is always receiving information and storing it up without it actually going through the cortex, that is, let's say, the top of the head. We're not aware that we are receiving stimuli, information. We're not aware of it, but it is going into us and is there available for use. Now, as we become more sensitive to people, as more of our spiritual and psychic force is available to use in relation to them and love them, we become able to respond not on the basis of laws, principles, rules, but intuitively. And I can't tell you how to get intuition any more than a woman can tell what intuition is. When a woman says, if you say to a woman, why did you do that? She says, well, because. And that's a pretty good answer. It really is. She means, I felt intuitively that was the appropriate response. I don't know when you challenge people except as you feel inwardly led.
Doctor, did you ever challenge somebody who wasn't sure whether you should have or not?
Whether what?
You should have or not? I mean, the results sometimes look like perhaps it was a myth.
I mean, do we ever wonder?
It's a challenge, yes. I mean, have you ever been in a situation yourself? So you have a tremendous amount of psychological knowledge. And yet in that folder that you sent out, you said that late recently there has been a test where this training is not necessary in a group. What takes the place of it? And then in your own experience, have you ever placed a challenge that later you have thought perhaps that I had better have not said?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. She was asking, in case you couldn't hear, two questions. First of all, asking if I'd ever given somebody a challenge and felt later it was a mistake. Oh, yes. I leave every group session wishing I had done something else other than I had done. But not as often as I used to. Now, the astounding thing is, if there are 10 people in a group, there may be, mathematically, 500,000 different things that could happen. Instead of this, this. Instead of this, that. Depending on who says what. So we play it by ear and it will always be imperfect. She was referring also to the fact that in our newsletter, mention was made of the findings of the Western Behavioral Institute at La Jolla, Carl Rogers' outfit. Reference was made there to the fact that they discovered that leaderless groups can be just about as effective as groups led by trained therapists. That needs to be elaborated upon and takes a little time. At our last Acelomar conference, Larry Solomon from the Western Behavioral Institute described their experiments there and what they're doing. They're working out various devices and processes which are to take and do take the place of a trained leader. And they found that when these various methods are used in a leaderless group, they get about the same results they do if it's led by a trained group therapist. Now, to this point, they're not ready to give out all of these materials because they're still improving on them. Up to this point, however, we have discovered that through the use of these spiritual growth inventories, we have, for the moment, we believe, the best available material for a lay-led group. Are you familiar with these spiritual growth inventories? Well, very briefly, they were devised by Dr. William F. Parker. They're simple, They're simply psychological tests, standardized tests, as a result of which some profiles are drawn up. The first one we use is the MMPI, and there are 11 different areas up here covered, 11 different areas of personality, and a lot of numbers along here. If a person falls within these two lines, these are considered safe. But if his profile looks sort of like that, at this point, he would get a slip, perhaps two or three paragraphs in length, maybe up to half a page, indicating that at this point, on this item, he needs attention. This is strong. On the next item, this is mild. This, we would say, is excessive. This is mild, this is strong, this is excessive. So there's seven areas out of 11 where he would get a succession of 11, seven different slips. We decided, early in the scheme of things, to give everybody 11 slips. Some people get three, some will get 11, some nine. The people who got three felt they were better off than the people who got 11. And maybe they weren't. So to avoid comparisons, we decided then to take another test called the draw a person. And you just draw a picture of a person, and from this, we can score this and interpret this and give another four, a total of 11 different slips. Believe it or not, if you do a picture like this, we can tell a lot about you. An artistic ability has nothing to do with it. In fact, an artist's drawing is hard to interpret because it's artificial. It's easier to kid ourselves and lie ourselves to ourselves on this than it is on this, because here we're answering verbal questions, and here we don't know what to lie about. So we give them 11 slips. So every other week for 11 weeks, the leader hands out in a sealed envelope a succession of slips, one to each person in the group. They're sealed for privacy. After the first week, nobody cares. First, we hold it pretty close to our vest. I want to make sure everybody else is sick as we are. We got some of the funniest comments back. Thrilling, wonderful, fantastic. One came in yesterday. Comments after the sessions were over. A woman wrote in and said, a wonderful experience. Wouldn't have been without it. So the one slip I got, which you mentioned, made me so mad, I tore it up immediately. One man flushed all of his down the toilet. And he sent in later more copies. Some people say, no, I must have answered that all wrong. And you say to his wife, is this slip of his valid? She says, 100%. You see, our capacity for self-deception is enormous. Now, getting back to this leaderless thing, or this lay-led group, the slips take the place of a trained leader. Now, what has psychology got to do with religion? Well, everything. Because we say that Jesus was interested in anything that happens to a person. Mental, physical, spiritual, domestic, you name it. All right? So we do not separate psychological truth from theological truth. It's just the person. On the bottom of every slip, there is reference to the fact that in the final analysis, it is God who heals us. It is divine through divine power and God's grace that we will get better. There's a reminder to have a quiet time, daily quiet time. Every slip almost has a reminder of this quiet time. And books are suggested. Each person in the group is supposed to have the same book which they're studying. In fact, they study two books during this series. You may be interested to know that we have in our groups across the country now, especially in the West Coast, we have we've got two groups led by a Jewish rabbi. I don't know what he does with his Christian orientation. I wrote him and asked him the other day. I haven't heard from him yet. He's a PhD and leads two groups at the University of Southern California. We have Roman Catholics and 26 denominations in our groups. We have some psychiatrists and some psychologists using these slips as an aid to open the people up. Now, for instance, if a psychiatrist using his insight probes and pokes, the person may become defensive. Or from a leader, any leader. But when I open up my envelope and I take out my slip, here is the result of what I have said about myself. And I can accept my findings about myself better than I can what you have to say, because you might judge me. It isn't always easy to accept this, but it's easier than if you said it. So this is how we get by without a lot of tribulation. Yes, we have some groups where they rotate leaders, leadership, built color groups. In that sense, they have no one leader. I don't know that this is best, but some groups like it fine. Carl Rogers' studies, however, are based on leaderless groups. There is no leader. At every session, they open up an envelope which says, this week, you'll do the following. Go to the blackboard and list, this is just typical, list all of the traits about each person in the group as you see them. And they just follow these instructions and sit down and talk about it. There's no leader.
But didn't you say that the effectiveness of it hinged a little bit on having people who had group experience before in the group?
They were more effective if they had had some experience. And you recognize, too, that leadership always emerges in a group. You can't avoid this, that it is not to be avoided. There are people, people in a group who just automatically assume leadership. Not because they want to be, but because they're less inhibited or they're more insightful or whatever. I think we will break up now for lunch, take about 15 minutes. And, you know, how long before lunch? About 20 minutes, and then we'll eat. Both in the rear room. Babette, in the rear room. In the... We'll meet in... Virtues than our defects. partly because we're afraid that people will think we are vain. Any of us who are ever be thought of as sinners is going to be thought of as vain, which we all are. I mean, we're all vain. So, if you can think of five virtues, and all of us have got scores, you'd want to give those. And then we want three or more basic defects, needs, growth goals towards which you would hope to grow, personal problems or your own personal sins. I don't care what they are. Be the sin of being a carnal member of the human race, if you want to be that general. Or it could be that you've discovered that you are a hostile person, all right? Now, this involves a certain amount of openness. Nothing need be shared which could ever be a morsel of gossip. This is a small personal group. We've never tell anybody about it. Just our wives, a few others.